Many people had said they wouldn't come to any speaking. They were good Catholics, weren't they? Hadn't the bishop told them that the speaker spoke with Satan's voice? But other things were whispered, too, once the speaker came. Rumors, mostly. But Milagre was a little place where rumors were the sauce of dry life, and rumors have no value unless they are believed. So word spread that Marcaun's little girl Quara, who had been silent since he died, was now so talkative that it got her in trouble in school. And Olhado, that ill-mannered boy with the repulsive metal eyes, it was said that he suddenly seemed cheerful and excited, perhaps manic, perhaps possessed. Rumors began to imply that somehow the speaker had a healing touch, that he had the evil eye, that his blessings made you whole, his curses could kill you, his words could charm you into obedience. Not everybody heard this, of course, and not everybody who heard it believed it. But in the 4 days between the speaker's arrival and the evening of his speaking the death of Marcos Maria Ribeira, the community of Milagre decided, without any formal announcement, that they would come to the speaking and hear what the speaker had to say, whether the bishop said to stay away or not. It was the bishop's own fault. From his vantage point, calling the speaker satanic put Andrew Wigan at the farthest extreme from himself and all good Catholics. The speaker is the opposite of us. But to those who are not theologically sophisticated, well, Satan was frightening and powerful, so was God. They understood well enough the continuum of good and evil that the bishop referred to, but they were far more interested in the continuum of strong and weak. That was the one they lived with day by day. And on that continuum, they were weak, and God and Satan and the bishop all were strong. The bishop had elevated the speaker to stand with him as a man of power. The people were thus prepared to believe the whispered hints of miracles. So even though the announcement came only an hour before the speaking, the praça was full, and people gathered in the buildings and houses that fronted the praça and crowded the grassy alleyways and streets. Mayor Basquina had, as the law required, provided the speaker with a simple microphone that she used for the rare public meetings. People oriented themselves toward the platform where he would stand, and they looked around to see who was there. Everyone was there. Of course, Marcaun's family. Of course, the mayor. But also Dom Cristán and Dona Cristán and many a robed priest from the cathedral, Dr. Navio, Pipo's widow, old Concepcion, the archivist, Libo's widow, Prusinha, and her children. It was rumored that the speaker also meant to speak Pipo's and Libo's death someday, too. And finally, just as the speaker stepped up onto the platform, the rumor swept the praça. Bishop Peregrino was here, not in his vestments, but in the simple robes of a priest, here himself, to hear the speaker's blasphemy. Many a citizen of Milagre felt a delicious thrill of anticipation. Would the bishop rise up and miraculously strike down Satan? Would there be a battle here such as had not been seen outside the vision of the apocalypse of St. John? Then the speaker stood before the microphone and waited for them to be still. He was fairly tall, youngish still, but his white skin made him look sickly compared to the thousand shades of brown of the Lusos. Ghostly. They fell silent, and he began to speak.
He was known by 3 names. The official records have the first one, Marcos Maria Ribeira. And his official data, born 1929, died 1970. Worked in the steel foundry, perfect safety record, never arrested, a wife, 6 children, a model citizen because he never did anything bad enough to go on the public record.
Many who were listening felt a vague disquiet. They had expected oration. Instead, the speaker's voice was nothing remarkable, and his words had none of the formality of religious speech. Plain, simple, almost conversational. Only a few of them noticed that its very simplicity made his voice, his speech, utterly believable. He wasn't telling the truth with trumpets. He was telling the truth, the story that you wouldn't think to doubt because it's taken for granted. Bishop Peregrino was one who noticed, and it made him uneasy. The speaker would be a formidable enemy, one who could not be blasted down with fire from before the altar.
The second name he had was Marcão, Big Marcos, because he was a giant of a man, reached his adult size early in his life. How old was he when he reached 2 meters? 11? Definitely by the time he was 12. His size and strength made him valuable in the foundry, where the lots of steel are so small that much of the work is controlled directly by hand, and strength matters. People's lives depended on Marcão's strength.
In the praça, the men from the foundry nodded. They had all bragged to each other that they'd never talked to the Framling atheist. Obviously, one of them had, but now it felt good that the speaker got it right, that he understood what they remembered of Marcão. Every one of them wished that he had been the one to tell about Marcão to the speaker. They did not guess that the speaker had not even tried to talk to them. After all these years, there were many things that Andrew Wiggin knew without asking.
His third name was Kaun, Dog.
Ah, yes, thought the Lusos. This is what we've heard about the speakers for the dead. They have no respect for the dead, no sense of decorum.
That was the name you used for him when you heard that his wife, Novinha, had another black eye, walked with a limp, had stitches in her lip. He was an animal to do that to her.
How dare he say that? The man's dead. But under their anger, the Lusos were uncomfortable for an entirely different reason. Almost all of them remembered saying or hearing exactly those words. The speaker's indiscretion was in repeating in public the words that they had used about Marcão when he was alive.
Not that any of you liked Novinha, not that cold woman who never gave any of you good morning, but she was smaller than he was, and she was the mother of his children, and when he beat her, he deserved the name of Kaun.
They were embarrassed. They muttered to each other. Those sitting in the grass near Novinha glanced at her and glanced away, eager to see how she was reacting, painfully aware of the fact that the speaker was right, that they didn't like her, that they at once feared and pitied her.
Tell me, is this the man you knew? Spent more hours in the bars than anybody, and yet never made any friends there. Never the camaraderie of alcohol for him. You couldn't even tell how much he had been drinking. He was surly and short-tempered before he had a drink, and surly and short-tempered just before he passed out. Nobody could tell the difference. You never heard of him having a friend, and none of you was ever glad to see him come into a room. That's the man you knew, most of you. Calm. Hardly a man at all.
Yes, they thought. That was the man. Now the initial shock of his indecorum had faded. They were accustomed to the fact that the speaker meant to soften nothing in his story, yet they were still uncomfortable, for there was a note of irony, not in his voice, but inherent in his words. Hardly a man at all, he had said. But of course he was a man, and they were vaguely aware that while the speaker understood what they thought of Marcão, he didn't necessarily agree.
A few others, the men from the foundry in Bairro das Fabricadoras, knew him as a strong arm they could trust. They knew he never said he could do more than he could do, and always did what he said he would do. You could count on him. So, within the walls of the foundry, he had their respect. But when you walked out the door, you treated him like everybody else, ignored him, thought little of him.
The irony was pronounced now, though the speaker gave no hint in his voice. Still the simple, plain speech he began with. The men who worked with him felt it wordlessly inside themselves. We should not have ignored him as we did. If he had worth inside the foundry, then perhaps we should have valued him outside too.
Some of you also know something else that you never talk about much. You know that you gave him the name Kaun long before he earned it. You were 10, 11, 12 years old. Little boys. He grew so tall, it made you ashamed to be near him, and afraid because he made you feel helpless.
Dom Christian murmured to his wife, "They came for gossip, and he gives them responsibility."
So you handled him the way human beings always handle things that are bigger than they are. You banded together, like hunters trying to bring down a mastodon, like bullfighters trying to weaken a giant bull to prepare it for the kill. Pokes, taunts, teases. Keep him turning around. He can't guess where the next blow is coming from. Prick him with barbs that stay under his skin. Weaken him with pain. Madden him because, big as he is, you can make him do things. You can make him yell. You can make him run. You can make him cry. See? He's weaker than you, after all.
Ella was angry. She had meant him to accuse Marcon, not excuse him. Just because he had a tough childhood didn't give him the right to knock Mother down whenever he felt like it.
There's no blame in this. You were children then, and children are cruel without knowing better. You wouldn't do that now. But now that I've reminded you, you can easily see an answer. You called him a dog, and so he became one for the rest of his life, hurting helpless people, beating his wife, speaking so cruelly and abusively to his son Miro that he drove the boy out of his house. He was acting out the way you treated him, becoming what you told him that he was.
You're a fool, thought Bishop Peregrino. If people only react to the way that others treat them, then nobody is responsible for anything. If your sins are not your own to choose, then how can you repent?
As if he heard the bishop's silent argument, the speaker raised a hand and swept away his own words.
But the easy answer isn't true. Your torments didn't make him violent, they made him sullen. And when you grew out of tormenting him, he grew out of hating you. He wasn't one to bear a grudge. His anger cooled and turned into suspicion. He knew you despised him. He learned to live without you, in peace.
The speaker paused a moment, and then gave voice to the question they silently were asking.
So, how did he become the cruel man you knew him to be? Think a moment. Who was it who tasted his cruelty? His wife. His children. Some people beat their wife and children because they lust for power, but are too weak or stupid to win power in the world. A helpless wife and children bound to such a man by need and custom and, bitterly enough, love, are the only victims he is strong enough to rule.
Yes, thought Ella, stealing a glance at her mother. This is what I wanted. This is why I asked him to speak father's death.
There are men like that. But Marcos Ibera wasn't one of them. Think a moment. Did you ever hear of him striking any of his children? Ever? You who worked with him, did he ever try to force his will on you? Seem resentful when things didn't go his way? Marcon was not a weak and evil man. He was a strong man. He didn't want power. He wanted love, not control, loyalty.
Bishop Peregrino smiled grimly, the way a duelist might salute a worthy opponent. You walk a twisted path, speaker, circling around the truth, fainting at it, and when you strike, your aim will be deadly. These people came for entertainment, but they are your targets. You will pierce them to the heart.
Some of you remember an incident. Marcos was maybe 13, and so were you. Taunting him on the grassy hillside behind the school. You attacked more viciously than usual. You threatened him with stones, whipped him with capim blades. You bloodied him a little, but he bore it, tried to evade you, asked you to stop. Then one of you struck him hard in the belly, and it hurt him more than you ever imagined, because even then he was already sick with the disease that finally killed him. He hadn't yet become accustomed to his fragility and pain. It felt like death to him. He was concerned. You were killing him, so he struck at you.
How did he know? Thought half a dozen men. It was so long ago. Who told him how it was? It was out of hand, that's all. We never meant anything, but when his arm swung out, his huge fist, like the kick of a cobra, he was going to hurt me.
It could have been any one of you that fell to the ground. You knew then that he was even stronger than you feared. What terrified you most, though, was that you knew exactly the revenge that you deserved. So you called for help, and when the teachers came, what did they see? One little boy on the ground, crying, bleeding. One large, man-sized child with a few scratches here and there saying, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to." And a half-dozen others saying, "He just hit him, started killing him for no reason. We tried to stop him, but Kaun is so big, he's always picking on the little kids."
Little Grego was caught up in the story. "Mentirosos!" he shouted. "They were lying!" Several people nearby chuckled. Quara shushed him.
So many witnesses. The teachers had no choice but to believe the accusation, until one girl stepped forward and coldly informed them that she had seen it all. Marcos was acting to protect himself from a completely unwarranted, vicious, painful attack by a pack of boys who were acting far more like cows, like dogs, than Marcos Ribera ever did. Her story was instantly accepted as the truth. After all, she was the daughter of Os Venerados.
Grego looked at his mother with glowing eyes, then jumped up and announced to the people around him, "Ah, Maman Oliberto! Mama saved him!" People laughed, turned around and looked at Novinia, but she held her face expressionless, refusing to acknowledge their momentary affection for her child. They looked away again, offended.
Novinia, her cold manner and bright mind, made her just as much an outcast among you as Marcão. None of you could think of a time when she had ever made a friendly gesture toward any of you. And here she was, saving Marcão. Well, you knew the truth. She wasn't saving Marcão. She was preventing you from getting away with something.
They nodded and smiled knowingly, those people whose overtures of friendship she had just rebuffed. That's Donna Novinia, the biologista, too good for any of the rest of us.
Marcos didn't see it that way. He had been called an animal so often that he almost believed it. Novinia showed him compassion like a human being, a pretty girl, a brilliant child, the daughter of the Holy Venerados, always aloof as a goddess. She had reached down and blessed him and granted his prayer. He worshipped her. 6 years later, he married her. Isn't that a lovely story?
Ella looked at Miro, who raised an eyebrow at her. "Almost makes you like the old bastard, doesn't it?" said Miro dryly. Suddenly, after a long pause, the speaker's voice erupted, louder than ever before. It startled them, awoke them.
"Why did he come to hate her, to beat her, to despise their children? And why did she endure it, this strong-willed, brilliant woman? She could have stopped the marriage at any moment. The church may not allow divorce, but there's always the Desquite. And she wouldn't be the first person in Milagre to quit her husband. She could have taken her suffering children and left him, but she stayed. The mayor and the bishop both suggested that she leave him. She told them they could go to hell."
Many of the Lusos laughed. They could imagine tight-lipped Novinia snapping at the bishop himself, facing down Bosquinha. They might not like Novinia much, but she was just about the only person in Milagre who could get away with thumbing her nose at authority. The bishop remembered the scene in his chambers more than a decade ago, She had not used exactly the words the speaker quoted, but the effect was much the same. Yet he had been alone. He had told no one. Who was this speaker? And how did he know so much about things he could not possibly have known? When the laughter died, the speaker went on.
There was a tie that bound them together in a marriage they hated. That tie was Marcaun's disease.
His voice was softer now, the Luso strained to hear.
It shaped his life from the moment he was conceived. The genes his parents gave him combined in such a way that from the moment puberty began, the cells of his glands began a steady, relentless transformation into fatty tissues. Dr. Navio can tell you how it progresses better than I can. Marcaun knew from childhood that he had this condition. His parents knew it before they died in the Descolada. Gusto and Sida knew it from their genetic examinations of all the humans of Lusitania. They were all dead. Only one other person knew it. The one who had inherited the xenobiological files. Novinia.
Dr. Navio was puzzled. If she knew this before they married, she surely knew that most people who had his condition were sterile. Why would she have married him when for all she knew he had no chance of fathering children? Then he realized what he should have known before, that Marcaun was not a rare exception to the pattern of the disease. There were no exceptions. Navio's face reddened. What the speaker was about to tell them was unspeakable.
Novinia knew that Marcaun was dying. She also knew before she married him that he was absolutely and completely sterile.
It took a moment for the meaning of this to sink in. Ella felt as if her organs were melting inside her body. She saw without turning her head that Miro had gone rigid, that his cheeks had paled. Speaker went on despite the rising whispers from the audience.
I saw the genetic scans. Marcos Maria Hibera never fathered a child. His wife had children, but they were not his, and he knew it, and she knew he knew it. It was part of the bargain that they made when they got married.
The murmurs turned to muttering, the grumbles to complaints, and as the noise reached a climax, King leaped to his feet and shouted, screamed at the speaker, "My mother is not an adulteress. I'll kill you for calling her a whore." His last word hung in the silence. The speaker did not answer. He only waited, not letting his gaze drop from Keen's burning face, until finally King realized that it was he, not the speaker, whose voice had said the word that kept ringing in his ears. He faltered. He looked at his mother sitting beside him on the ground, but not rigidly now, slumped a little now, looking at her hands as they trembled in her lap. "Tell them, mother," Keen said. His voice sounded more pleading than he had intended. She didn't answer, didn't say a word, didn't look at him. If he didn't know better, he would think her trembling hands were a confession, that she was ashamed, as if what the speaker said was the truth that God himself would tell if Keen were to ask him. He remembered Father Mateo explaining the tortures of hell. God spits on adulterers. They mock the power of creation that he shared with them. They haven't enough goodness in them to be anything better than amoebas. Keen tasted bile in his mouth. What the speaker said was true. "Mamau," he said loudly, mockingly, "quem fode prafazerme?" People gasped. Olijado jumped to his feet at once, his hands doubled in fists. Only then did Novinia react, reaching out a hand as if to restrain Olijado from hitting his brother. King hardly noticed that Olijado had leapt to his mother's defense. All he could think of was the fact that Miro had not. Miro also knew that it was true. King breathed deeply, then turned round, looking lost for a moment. Then he threaded his way through the crowd. No one spoke to him, though everyone watched him go. If Novinia had denied the charge, they would have believed her, would have mobbed the speaker for accusing Os Venerados' daughter of such a sin. But she had not denied it. She had listened to her own son accuse her obscenely, and she said nothing. It was true, and now they listened in fascination. Few of them had any real concern. They just wanted to learn who had fathered Novena's children. The speaker quietly resumed his tale.
After her parents died, and before her children were born, Novena loved only two people. Pipo was her second father. Novena anchored her life in him. For a few short years, she had a taste of what it meant to have a family. Then he died, and Novena believed that she had killed him.
People sitting near Novena's family saw Quara kneel in front of Ella and ask her, "Why is Keen so angry?" Ella answered softly, "Because Papai was not really our father." "Oh," said Quara, "is the speaker our father now?" She sounded hopeful. Ella shushed her.
The night Pipo died, Novena showed him something that she had discovered, something to do with the Descolada and the way it works with the plants and animals of Lusitania. Pipo saw more in her work than she did herself. He rushed to the forest where the piggies waited. Perhaps he told them what he had discovered. Perhaps they only guessed. But Novena blamed herself for showing him a secret that the piggies would kill to keep. It was too late to undo what she had done, but she could keep it from happening again. So she sealed up all the files that had anything to do with the Descolada and what she had shown to Pipo that night. She knew who would want to see the files. It was Libo, the new Zenador. If Pipo had been her father, Libo had been her brother, and more than a brother. Hard as it was to bear Pipo's death, Libo's would be worse. He asked for the files. He demanded to see them. She told him she would never let him see them. They both knew exactly what that meant. If he ever married her, he could strip away the protection on those files. They loved each other desperately. They needed each other more than ever, but Novena could never marry him. He would never promise not to read the files, and even if he made such a promise, he couldn't keep it. He would surely see what his father saw. He would die. It was one thing to refuse to marry him. It was another thing to live without him. So she didn't live without him. She made her bargain with Marcaun. She would marry him under the law, but her real husband and the father of all her children was Libo.
Bruxinha, Libo's widow, rose shakily to her feet, tears streaming down her face, and wailed, "Mentira, mentira! Lies, lies!" But her weeping was not anger. It was grief. She was mourning the loss of her husband all over again. Three of her daughters helped her leave the praça. Softly, the speaker continued while she left.
Libo knew that he was hurting his wife, Bruxinha, and their four daughters. He hated himself for what he had done. He tried to stay away. For months, sometimes years, he succeeded. Novena also tried. She refused to see him, even to speak to him. She forbade her children to mention him. Then Libo would think that he was strong enough to see her without falling back into the old way. Novena would be so lonely with her husband, who could never measure up to Libo. They never pretended there was anything good about what they were doing. They just couldn't live for long without it.
Bruxinha heard this as she was led away. It was little comfort to her now, of course. But as Bishop Peregrino watched her go, he recognized that the speaker was giving her a gift. She was the most innocent victim of his cruel truth, but he didn't leave her with nothing but ashes. He was giving her a way to live with the knowledge of what her husband did. "It was not your fault," he was telling her. "Nothing you did could have prevented it. Your husband was the one who failed, not you." "Blessed Virgin," prayed the bishop silently, "let Bruxinha hear what he says and believe it." Libo's widow was not the only one who cried. Many hundreds of the eyes that watched her go were also filled with tears. To discover Novenia was an adulteress was shocking, but delicious. The steel-hearted woman had a flaw that made her no better than anyone else. But there was no pleasure in finding the same flaw in Lebo. Everyone had loved him. His generosity, his kindness, his wisdom that they so admired, they didn't want to know that it was all a mask. So they were surprised when the speaker reminded them that it was not Lebo whose death he spoke today.
Why did Marcos Ibera consent to this? Novenia thought it was because he wanted a wife and the illusion that he had children. To take away his shame in the community. It was partly that. Most of all, though, he married her because he loved her. He never really hoped that she would love him the way he loved her, because he worshipped her. She was a goddess, and he knew that he was diseased, filthy, an animal to be despised. He knew she could not worship him or even love him. He hoped that she might someday feel some affection, that she might feel some loyalty.
The speaker bowed his head a moment. The Lusos heard the words that he did not have to say. She never did.
Each child that came was another proof to Marcos that he had failed, that the goddess still found him unworthy. Why? He was loyal. He had never hinted to any of his children that they were not his own. He never broke his promise to Novenia. Didn't he deserve something from her? At times, it was more than he could bear. He refused to accept her judgment. She was no goddess. Her children were all bastards. This is what he told himself when he lashed out at her, when he shouted at Miro.
Miro heard his own name, but didn't recognize it as anything to do with him. His connection with reality was more fragile than he ever had supposed, and today had given him too many shocks. The impossible magic with the piggies in the trees. Mother and Lebo, lovers. Wanda suddenly torn from being as close to him as his own body, his own self. She was now set back at one remove, like Ella, like Quara, another sister. His eyes did not focus on the grass. The speaker's voice was pure sound. He didn't hear meanings in the words, only the terrible sound. Miro had called for that voice, had wanted it to speak Lebo's death. How could he have known that instead of a benevolent priest of a humanist religion, he would get the original speaker himself, with his penetrating mind and far too perfect understanding? He could not have known that beneath that emphatic mask would be hiding Ender, the destroyer, the mythic Lucifer of mankind's greatest crime, determined to live up to his name, making a mockery of the life work of Pipo, Lebo, Wanda, and Miro himself, by seeing in a single hour with the piggies what all the others had failed in almost 50 years to see, and then riving Wanda from him with a single merciless stroke from the blade of truth. That was the voice that Miro heard, the only certainty left to him, that relentless, terrible voice. Miro clung to the sound of it, trying to hate it, yet failing because he knew, could not deceive himself, he knew that Ender was a destroyer. But what he destroyed was illusion, and the illusion had to die. The truth about the piggies, the truth about ourselves. Somehow this ancient man is able to see the truth, and it doesn't blind his eyes or drive him mad. I must listen to this voice and let its power come to me so I, too, can stare at the light and not die.
Novenia knew what she was. An adulteress, a hypocrite. She knew she was hurting Marcaun, Lebo, her children, Brushinia. She knew she had killed Pipo. So she endured, even invited Marcaun's punishment. It was her penance. It was never penance enough. No matter how much Marcaun might hate her, she hated herself more.
The bishop nodded slowly. The speaker had done a monstrous thing, to lay these secrets before the whole community. They should have been spoken in the confessional. Yet Peregrino had felt the power of it. the way the whole community was forced to discover these people that they thought they knew, and then discover them again and then again. And each revision of the story forced them all to reconceive themselves as well, for they had been part of this story too, had been touched by all the people 100, 1,000 times, never understanding until now who it was they touched. It was a painful, fearful thing to go through, but in the end it had a curiously calming effect. The bishop leaned to his secretary and whispered,
"At least the gossips will get nothing from this. There aren't any secrets left to tell."
All the people in this story suffered pain. All of them sacrificed for the people they loved. All of them caused terrible pain to the people who loved them. And you, listening to me here today, you also caused pain. But remember this. Marcaun's life was tragic and cruel, but he could have ended his bargain with Novenia at any time. He chose to stay. He must have found some joy in it. And Novenia? She broke the laws of God that bind this community together. She has also borne her punishment. The church asks for no penance as terrible as the one she imposed on herself. And if you're inclined to think that she might deserve some petty cruelty at your hands, keep this in mind. She suffered everything, did all this for one purpose: to keep the piggies from killing Lebo.
The words left ashes in their hearts.
Olhado stood and walked to his mother, knelt by her, put an arm around her shoulder. Ella sat beside her, but she was folded to the ground, weeping. Kara came and stood in front of her mother, staring at her with awe, and Grego buried his face in Novenia's lap and wept. Those who were near enough could hear him crying, "Todo papai è morto. Non tenho nem papai. All my papas are dead. I don't have any papa." Wanda stood in the mouth of the alley where she had gone with her mother just before the speaking ended. She looked for Miro, but he was already gone. Ender stood behind the platform, looking at Novenia's family, wishing he could do something to ease their pain. There was always pain after a speaking, because a speaker for the dead did nothing to soften the truth, but only rarely had people lived such lives of deceit as Marcaun, Lebo, and Novenia. Rarely were there so many shocks, so many bits of information that forced people to revise their conception of the people that they knew, the people that they loved. Ender knew from the faces that looked up at him as he spoke that he had caused great pain today. He had felt it all himself, as if they had passed their suffering to him. Rusinia had been most surprised, but Ender knew she was not worst injured. That distinction belonged to Miro and Wanda, who had thought they knew what the future would bring them. But Ender had also felt the pain that people felt before, and he knew that today's new wounds would heal much faster than the old ones ever would have done. Novenia might not recognize it, but Ender had stripped from her a burden that was much too heavy for her to bear any longer.
"Speaker," said Mayor Bosquinha.
"Mayor," said Ender. He didn't like talking to people after a speaking, but he was used to the fact that someone always insisted on talking to him. He forced a smile. "There were many more people here than I expected." "A momentary thing for most of them," said Bosquinha. "They'll forget it by morning." Ender was annoyed that she was trivializing it. "Only if something monumental happens in the night," he said. "Yes, well, that has been arranged." Only then did Ender realize that she was extremely upset, barely under control at all. He took her by the elbow and then cast an arm over her shoulder. She leaned gratefully.
"Speaker, I came to apologize. Your starship has been commandeered by Starways Congress. It has nothing to do with you. A crime was committed here, a crime so terrible that the criminals must be taken to the nearest world, Trondheim, for trial and punishment. Your ship."
Ender reflected for a moment. "Miro and Wanda?" She turned her head, looked at him sharply.
You are not surprised. I also won't let them go. Loskynia pulled herself away from him.
Won't let them?
I have some idea what they're charged with. You've been here 4 days, and you already know something that even I never suspected. Sometimes the government is the last to know. Let me tell you why you will let them go, why we'll all let them go to stand trial. Because Congress has stripped our files. The computer memory is empty except for the most rudimentary programs that control our power supply, our water, our sewer. Tomorrow no work can be done because we haven't enough power to run any of the factories, to work in the mines, to power the tractors. I have been removed from office. I am now nothing more than the deputy chief of police to see that the directives of the Lusitanian Evacuation Committee are carried out. Evacuation. The colony's license has been revoked. They're sending starships to take us all away. Every sign of human habitation here is to be removed, even the gravestones that mark our dead. Ender tried to measure her response. He had not thought Boskynia was the kind who would bow to mindless authority. Do you intend to submit to this? The power and water supplies are controlled by Ansible. They also control the fence. They can shut us in here without power or water or sewers, and we can't get out. Once Miro and Wanda are aboard your starship, headed for Trondheim, they say that some of the restrictions will be relaxed. She sighed. Oh, Speaker, I'm afraid this isn't a good time to be a tourist in Lusitania. I'm not a tourist. He didn't bother telling her his suspicion that it might not be pure coincidence, Congress noticing the questionable activities when Ender happened to be there. Were you able to save any of your files? Boskynia sighed. By imposing on you, I'm afraid. I noticed that all your files were maintained by Ansible, off-world. We sent our most crucial files as messages to you. Ender laughed. Good. That's right. That was well done. It doesn't matter. We can't get them back. Or, well, yes we can, but they'll notice it at once, and then you'll be in just as much trouble as the rest of us, and they'll wipe out everything then. Unless you sever the Ansible connection immediately after copying all my files to local memory. Then we really would be in rebellion. And for what? For the chance to make Lusitania the best and most important of the 100 worlds. Boskynia laughed. I think they'll regard us as important, but treason is hardly the way to be known as the best. Please, don't do anything. Don't arrest Miro and Wanda. Wait for an hour, and let me meet with you and anyone else who needs to be in on the decision. The decision whether or not to rebel? I can't think why you should be in on that decision, Speaker. You'll understand at the meeting. Please, this place is too important for the chance to be missed. The chance for what? To undo what Ender did in the Xenocide 3,000 years ago. Boskynia gave him a sharp-eyed look. And here I thought you had just proved yourself to be nothing but a gossip monger. She might have been joking, or she might not. If you think that what I just did was gossip mongering, you're too stupid to lead this community in anything. He smiled. Boskynia spread her hands and shrugged. Pois A, she said. Of course. What else? Will you have the meeting? I'll call it. In the bishop's chambers. Ender winced. The bishop won't meet anywhere else, she said, and no decision to rebel will mean a thing if he doesn't agree to it. Boskynia laid her hand on his chest. He may not even let you into the cathedral. You are the infidel. But you'll try. I'll try because of what you did tonight. Only a wise man could see my people so clearly in so short a time. Only a ruthless one would say it all out loud. Your virtue and your flaw, we need them both. Boskynia turned and hurried away. Ender knew that she did not, in her inmost heart, want to comply with Starway's Congress. It had been too sudden, too severe. They had preempted her authority as if she were guilty of a crime. To give in smacked of confession, and she knew she had done nothing wrong. She wanted to resist, wanted to find some plausible way to slap back at Congress and tell them to wait, to be calm, or if necessary, to tell them to drop dead. But she wasn't a fool. She wouldn't do anything to resist them unless she knew it would work and knew it would benefit her people. She was a good governor,
and her new. She would gladly sacrifice her pride, her reputation, her future, for her people's sake. He was alone in the praza. Everyone had gone while Boskinya talked to him. Ender felt as an old soldier must feel walking over placid fields at the sight of a long-ago battle, hearing the echoes of the carnage and the breeze across the rustling grass. "Don't let them sever the Ansible connection." The voice in his ear startled him, but he knew it at once. "Jane," he said, "I can make them think you've cut off your Ansible, but if you really do it, then I won't be able to help you." "Jane," he said, "you did this, didn't you? Why else would they notice what Lebo and Miro and Wanda have been doing if you didn't call it to their attention?" She didn't answer. "Jane, I'm sorry that I cut you off. I'll never..." He knew she knew what he would say. He didn't have to finish sentences with her. But she didn't answer. "I'll never turn off the..." What good did it do to finish sentences that he knew she understood? She hadn't forgiven him yet, that was all, or she would already be answering, telling him to stop wasting her time. Yet he couldn't keep himself from trying one more time. "I missed you, Jane. I really missed you." Still, she didn't answer. She had said what she had to say to keep the Ansible connection alive, and that was all. For now, Ender didn't mind waiting. It was enough to know that she was still there, listening. He wasn't alone. Ender was surprised to find tears on his cheeks. Tears of relief, he decided. Catharsis. A speaking. A crisis. People's lives in tatters. The future of the colony in doubt. And I cry in relief because an overblown computer program is speaking to me again. Ella was waiting for him in his little house. Her eyes were red from crying. "Hello," she said. "Did I do what you wanted?" he asked. "I never guessed," she said. "He wasn't our father. I should have known." "I can't think how you could have." "What have I done? Calling you here to speak my father's... Akan's death." She began weeping again. "Mother's secrets. I thought I knew what they were. I thought it was just her files. I thought she hated Lebo. All I did was open the windows and let in some air. Tell that to Miro and Wanda." "Think a moment, Ella. They would have found out eventually. The cruel thing was that they didn't know for so many years. Now that they have the truth, they can find their own way out. Like Mother did. Only this time even worse than adultery." Ender touched her hair, smoothed it. She accepted his touch, his consolation. He couldn't remember if his father or mother had ever touched him with such a gesture. They must have. How else would he have learned it? "Ella, will you help me?"
"Help you what? You've done your work, haven't you?"
"This has nothing to do with speaking for the dead. I have to know within the hour how the Descolada works."
"You'll have to ask Mother. She's the one who knows."
"I don't think she'd be glad to see me tonight."
"I'm supposed to ask her? Good evening, Maman. You've just been revealed to all of Milagre as an adulteress who's been lying to your children all our lives. So if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to ask you a couple of science questions."
"Ella, it's a matter of survival for Lusitania, not to mention you, Brother Miro." He reached over and turned to the terminal. "Log on," he said. She was puzzled, but she did it. The computer wouldn't recognize her name. "I've been taken off." She looked at him in alarm. "Why?" "It's not just you, it's everybody."
"It isn't the breakdown," she said.
"Somebody stripped out the logon file." "Starways Congress stripped all the local computer memory. Everything's gone. We're regarded as being in a state of rebellion. Miro and Wanda are going to be arrested and sent to Trondheim for trial. Unless I can persuade the bishop and Boskinya to launch a real rebellion. Do you understand? If your mother doesn't tell you what I need to know, Miro and Wanda will both be sent 22 light-years away. The penalty for treason is death. But even going to the trial is as bad as life imprisonment. We'll all be dead or very, very old before they get back." Ella looked blankly at the wall.
"What do you need to know?"
"I need to know what the committee will find when they open up her files about how the Descolada works."
"Yes," said Ella.
"For Miro's sake, she'll do it." She looked at him defiantly. "She does love us, you know. For one of her children, she'd talk to you herself."
"Good," said Ender.
"It would be better if she came herself to the bishop's chambers in an hour."
Yes, said Ella. For a moment she sat still. Then a synapse connected somewhere, and she stood up and hurried toward the door. She stopped. She came back, embraced him, kissed him on the cheek. I'm glad you told it all, she said. I'm glad to know it. He kissed her forehead and sent her on her way. When the door closed behind her, he sat down on his bed, then lay down and stared at the ceiling. He thought of Novinia, tried to imagine what she was feeling now. No matter how terrible it is, Novinia, your daughter is hurrying home to you right now, sure that despite the pain and humiliation you're going through, you'll forget yourself completely and do whatever it takes to save your son. I would trade you all your suffering, Novinia, for one child who trusted me like that.
Chapter 16. The Fence. A great rabbi stands teaching in the marketplace. It happens that a husband finds proof that morning of his wife's adultery, and a mob carries her to the marketplace to stone her to death. There is a familiar version of this story, but a friend of mine, a speaker for the dead, has told me of two other rabbis that faced the same situation. Those are the ones I'm going to tell you. The rabbi walks forward and stands beside the woman. Out of respect for him, the mob forbears and waits with the stones heavy in their hands. Is there anyone here, he says to them, who has not desired another man's wife, another woman's husband? They murmur and say, we all know the desire. But Rabbi, none of us has acted on it. The rabbi says, then kneel down and give thanks that God made you strong. He takes the woman by the hand and leads her out of the market. Just before he lets her go, he whispers to her, tell the Lord Magistrate who saved his mistress. Then he'll know I am his loyal servant. So the woman lives, because the community is too corrupt to protect itself from disorder. Another rabbi, another city. He goes to her and stops the mob, as in the other story, and says, which of you is without sin? Let him cast the first stone. The people are abashed, and they forget their unity of purpose in the memory of their own individual sins. Someday they think, I may be like this woman, and I'll hope for forgiveness and another chance. I should treat her the way I wish to be treated. As they open their hands and let the stones fall to the ground, the rabbi picks up one of the fallen stones, lifts it high over the woman's head, and throws it straight down with all his might. It crushes her skull and dashes her brains onto the cobblestones. Nor am I without sin, he says to the people. But if we allow only perfect people to enforce the law will soon be dead, and our city with it. So the woman died because her community was too rigid to endure her deviance. The famous version of this story is noteworthy because it is so startlingly rare in our experience. Most communities lurch between decay and rigor mortis, and when they veer too far, they die. Only one rabbi dared to expect of us such a perfect balance that we could preserve the law and still forgive the deviation. So, of course, we killed him. San Angelo, Letters to an Incipient Heretic, translated Amai a todo mundo para que Deus vos ame Christaum, 103-72-54-2.
Minha irmã. My sister. The words kept running through Miro's head until he didn't hear them anymore. They were part of the background. Awanda e minha irmã. She's my sister. His feet carried him by habit from the praça to the playing fields and over the saddle of the hill. The crown of the higher peak held the cathedral and the monastery, which always loomed over the Zenador's station as if they were a fortress keeping watch over the gate. Did Libo walk this way as he went to meet my mother? Did they meet in the xenobiologist's station? Or was it more discreet, rutting in the grass like hogs on the fazenda? He stood at the door of the Zenador station and tried to think of some reason to go inside. Nothing to do there. Hadn't written a report on what happened today, but he didn't know how to write it anyway. Magical powers, that's what it was. The piggies sing to the trees, and the trees split themselves into kindling. Much better than carpentry. The aboriginals are a good deal more sophisticated than previously supposed. Multiple uses for everything. Each tree is at once a totem, a grave marker, and a small lumber mill. Sister, there's something I have to do, but I can't remember. The piggies have the most sensible plan. Live as brothers only, and never mind the women. Would have been better for you, Libo, and that's the truth. No, I should call you Papai, not Libo. Too bad Mother never told you, or you could have dandled me on your knee. Both your eldest children, Wanda on one knee and Miro on the other. Aren't we proud of our two children, born the same year, only 2 months apart? What a busy fellow Papai was then, sneaking along the fence to tup Mamai in her own backyard. Everyone felt sorry for you because you had nothing but daughters, no one to carry on the family name. Their sympathy was wasted. You were brimming over with sons, and I have far more sisters than I ever thought. One more sister than I wanted. He stood at the gate, looking up toward the woods atop the Piggy's Hill. There is no scientific purpose to be served by visiting at night, so I guess I'll serve an unscientific purposelessness and see if they have room for another brother in the tribe. I'm probably too big for a bed space in the log house, so I'll sleep outside. And I won't be much for climbing trees, but I do know a thing or two about technology, and I don't feel any particular inhibitions now about telling you anything you want to know. He laid his right hand on the identification box and reached out his left to pull the gate. For a split second, he didn't realize what was happening. Then his hand felt like it was on fire, like it was being cut off with a rusty saw. He shouted and pulled his left hand away from the gate. Never, since the gate was built, had it stayed hot after the box was touched by the Zenador's hand. Marcos Vladimir Hibera von Hesse, your passage through the fence has been revoked by order of the Lusitanian Evacuation Committee. Never since the gate was built had the voice challenged the Zenador. It took a moment before Miro understood what it was saying. You and Wanda Kenyatta Figuera Mukumbi will present yourselves to Deputy Chief of Police Faria Lima Maria Doboski, who will arrest you in the name of Starways Congress and present you on Trondheim for trial. For a moment he was light-headed, and his stomach felt heavy and sick. They know. Tonight of all nights, everything over. Lose Wanda, lose the piggies, lose my work. All gone. Arrest. Trondheim, where the speaker came from. 22 years in transit. Everybody gone except Wanda. The only one left. And she's my sister. His hand flashed out again to pull at the gate. Again, the excruciating pain shot through his arm. The pain nerves all alerted, all afire at once. I can't just disappear. They'll seal the gate to everyone. Nobody will go to the piggies. Nobody will tell them. The piggies will wait for us to come, and no one will ever come out of the gate again. Not me, not Wanda, not the speaker. Nobody. And no explanation. Evacuation committee. They'll evacuate us and wipe out every trace of our being here. That much is in the rules. But there's more, isn't there? What did they see? How did they find out? Did the speaker tell them? He's so addicted to truth. I have to explain to the piggies why we won't be coming back. I have to tell them. A piggy always watched them, followed them from the moment they entered the forest. Could a piggy be watching now? Miro waved his hand. It was too dark, though. They couldn't possibly see him. Or perhaps they could. No one knew how good the piggy's vision was at night. Whether they saw him or not, they didn't come. And soon it would be too late. If the Framlings were watching the gate, they had no doubt already notified Bosquinha, and she'd be on her way, zipping over the grass. She would be oh so reluctant to arrest him, but she would do her job. And never mind arguing with her about whether it was good for humans or piggies, either one, to maintain this foolish separation. She wasn't the sort to question the law. She just did what she was told. And he'd surrender. There was no reason to fight. Where could he hide inside the fence? Out among the cabra herds? But before he gave up, he'd tell the piggies. He had to tell them. So he walked along the fence, away from the gate, toward the open grassland directly down the hill from the cathedral, where no one lived near enough to hear his voice. As he walked, he called, Not words, but a high hooting sound. A cry that he and Wanda used to call each other's attention when they were separated among the piggies. They'd hear it. They had to hear it. They had to come to him because he couldn't possibly pass the fence. So come, human, leaf-eater, Mandashuva, Arrow, Cups, Calendar, anyone, everyone, come and let me tell you that I cannot tell you any more.
King sat miserably on a stool in the bishop's office. Estefan, the bishop said quietly, there'll be a meeting here in a few minutes, but I want to talk to you a minute first. Nothing to talk about, said King. You warned us, and it happened. He's the devil. Estefan, we'll talk for a minute, and then you'll go home and sleep. Never going back there. The master ate with worse sinners than your mother and forgave them. Are you better than he? None of the adulteresses he forgave was his mother. Not everyone's mother can be the Blessed Virgin. Are you on his side, then? Has the church made way here for the speakers for the dead? Should we tear down the cathedral and use the stones to make an amphitheater where all our dead can be slandered before we lay them in the ground? A whisper. I am your bishop, Estefan, the vicar of Christ on this planet, and you will speak to me with the respect you owe to my office. King stood there, furious, unspeaking. I think it would have been better if the speaker had not told these stories publicly. Some things are better learned in privacy, in quiet, so that we need not deal with shocks while an audience watches us. That is why we use the confessional, to shield us from public shame while we wrestle with our private sins. But be fair, Estefan. The speaker may have told the stories, but the stories were all true. Nay? Eh? Now, Estefan, let us think. Before today, did you love your mother? Yes. And this mother that you loved, had she already committed adultery 10,000 times? I suspect she was not so libidinous as that. But you tell me that you loved her, though she was an adulteress. Isn't she the same person tonight? Has she changed between yesterday and today, or is it only you who have changed? What she was yesterday was a lie. Do you mean that because she was ashamed to tell her children that she was an adulteress, she must also have been lying when she cared for you all the years you were growing up, when she trusted you, when she taught you? She was not exactly a nurturing mother. If she had come to the confessional and won forgiveness for her adultery, then she would never have had to tell you at all. You would have gone to your grave not knowing. It would not have been a lie. Because she would have been forgiven, she would not have been an adulteress. Admit the truth, Estefan. You're not angry with her adultery. You're angry because you embarrassed yourself in front of a whole city by trying to defend her. You make me seem like a fool. No one thinks you're a fool. Everyone thinks you're a loyal son. But now, if you're to be a true follower of the Master, you will forgive her and let her see that you love her more than ever, because now you understand her suffering. The bishop glanced toward the door. I have a meeting here now, Estefan. Please, go into my inner chamber and pray to the Madalena to forgive you for your unforgiving heart. Looking more miserable than angry, King passed through the curtain behind the bishop's desk. The bishop's secretary opened the other door and let the speaker for the dead into the chamber. The bishop did not rise. To his surprise, the speaker knelt and bowed his head. It was an act that Catholics did only in a public presentation to the bishop, and Peregrino could not think what the speaker meant by this. Yet the man knelt there, waiting. And so the bishop arose from his chair and walked to him and held out his ring to be kissed. Even then the speaker waited until finally Peregrino said, I bless you, my son, even though I'm not sure whether you mock me with this obeisance. Head still bowed, the speaker said. There's no mockery in me. Then he looked up at Peregrino. My father was a Catholic. He pretended not to be for the sake of convenience, but he never forgave himself for his faithlessness.
You were baptized?
My sister told me that, yes. Father baptized me shortly after birth. My mother was a Protestant of a faith that deplored infant baptism, so they had a quarrel about it. The bishop held out his hand to lift the speaker to his feet. The speaker chuckled. Imagine, a closet Catholic and a lapsed Mormon quarreling over religious procedures that they both claimed not to believe in. Peregrino was skeptical. It was too elegant a gesture for the speaker to turn out to be a Catholic. I thought, said the bishop, that you speakers for the dead renounced all religions before taking up your, shall we say, vocation. I don't know what the others do. I don't think there are any rules about it, certainly. There weren't when I became a speaker. Bishop Peregrino knew that speakers were not supposed to lie, but this one certainly seemed to be evasive. Speaker Andrew, there isn't a place in all the 100 worlds where a Catholic has to conceal his faith, and there hasn't been for 3,000 years. That was the great blessing of space travel, that it removed the terrible population restrictions on an overcrowded Earth. Are you telling me that your father lived on Earth 3,000 years ago? I'm telling you that my father saw to it I was baptized a Catholic, and for his sake I did what he never could do in his life. It was for him that I knelt before a bishop and received his blessing. But it was you I blessed. And you are still dodging my question, which implies that my inference about your father's time of life is true, but you don't want to discuss it. Dom Pristown said that there was more to you than met the eye. Good, said the speaker. I need the blessing more than my father since he's dead, and I have many more problems to deal with. Please, sit down. The speaker chose a stool near the far wall. The bishop sat in his massive chair behind his desk. I wish you hadn't spoken today. It came at an inconvenient time. I had no warning that Congress would do this, but you knew that Miro and Wanda had violated the law. Boskinia told me. I found out only a few hours before the speaking. Thank you for not arresting them yet. That's a civil matter. The bishop brushed it aside. But they both knew that if he had insisted, Boskinia would have had to obey her orders and arrest them regardless of the speaker's request. Your speaking has caused a great deal of distress. More than usual, I'm afraid. So, is your responsibility over? Do you inflict the wounds and leave it to others to heal them? Not wounds, Bishop Peregrino. Surgery. And if I can help to heal the pain afterwards, then yes, I stay and help. I have no anesthesia, but I do try for antisepsis. You should have been a priest, you know. Younger sons used to have only two choices, the priesthood or the military. My parents chose the latter for me. A younger son. Yet you had a sister, and you lived in a time when population controls forbade parents to have more than two children. Unless the government gave special permission. They called such a child a third, yes? You know your history? Were you born on Earth before Starflight? What concerns us, Bishop Peregrino, is the future of Lusitania, not the biography of a speaker for the dead who is plainly only 35 years old. The future of Lusitania is my concern, Speaker Andrew, not yours. The future of the humans on Lusitania is your concern, Bishop. I'm concerned with the Pecaninos as well. Let's not compete to see whose concern is greater. The secretary opened the door again, and Boskinia, Dom Cristan, and Donna Cristan came in. Boskinia glanced back and forth between the bishop and the speaker. There's no blood on the floor, if that's what you're looking for, said the bishop. I was just estimating the temperature, said Boskinia. The warmth of mutual respect, I think, said the speaker, not the heat of anger or the ice of hate. The speaker is a Catholic by baptism, if not by belief, said the bishop. I blessed him, and it seemed to have made him docile. I've always been respectful of authority, said the speaker. You were the one who threatened us with an inquisitor, the bishop reminded him with a smile. The speaker's smile was just as chilly. And you're the one who told the people I was Satan, and they shouldn't talk to me. While the bishop and the speaker grinned at each other, the others laughed nervously, sat down, waited. It's your meeting, speaker, said Bosquinha. Forgive me, said the speaker. There's someone else invited. It'll make things much simpler if we wait a few more minutes for her to come.
Ella found her mother outside the house, not far from the fence. A light breeze that barely rustled the capim had caught her hair and tossed it lightly. It took a moment for Ella to realize why this was so startling. Her mother had not worn her hair down in many years. It looked strangely free, all the more so because Ella could see how it curled and bent where it had been so long forced into a bun. It was then that she knew that the speaker was right. Mother would listen to his invitation, whatever shame or pain tonight's speaking might have caused her. It led her now to stand out in the open, in the dusk just after sunset, looking toward the Piggy's Hill. Or perhaps she was looking at the fence. Perhaps remembering a man who met her here, or somewhere else in the capim, so that unobserved they could love each other. Always in hiding, always in secret. Mother is glad, thought Ella. To have it known that Lebo was her real husband, that Lebo is my true father. Mother is glad, and so am I. Mother did not turn to look at her, though she surely could hear Ella's approach through the noisy grass. Ella stopped a few steps away. Mother, she said. Not a herd of cabra, then, said Mother. You're so noisy, Ella. The speaker wants your help. Does he? Ella explained what the speaker had told her. Mother did not turn around. When Ella was finished, Mother waited a moment and then turned to walk over the shoulder of the hill. Ella ran after her, caught up with her. Mother, said Ella, Mother, are you going to tell him about the Descolada? Yes. Why now, after all these years, why wouldn't you tell me? Because you did better work on your own without my help. You know what I was doing? You're my apprentice. I have complete access to your files without leaving any footprints. What kind of master would I be if I didn't watch your work? But I also read the files you hid under Quara's name. You've never been a mother, so you didn't know that all the file activities of a child under 12 are reported to the parents every week. Quara was doing some remarkable research. I'm glad you're coming with me. When I tell the speaker, I'll be telling you, too. You're going the wrong way, said Ella. Mother stopped. Isn't the speaker's house near the Praça? The meeting is in the bishop's chambers. For the first time, Mother faced Ella directly. What are you and the speaker trying to do to me? We're trying to save Miro, said Ella. The Lusitania colony, if we can. Taking me to the spider's lair... The bishop has to be on our side, or our side. So when you say we, you mean you and the speaker, is that it? Do you think I haven't noticed that? All my children, one by one, he seduced you all. He hasn't seduced anybody. He seduced you with his way of knowing just what you want to hear. He's no flatterer, said Ella. He doesn't tell us what we want. He tells us what we know is true. He didn't win our affection. Mother, he won our trust. Whatever he gets from you, you never gave it to me. We wanted to. Ella did not bend this time before her mother's piercing, demanding glare. It was her mother, instead, who bent, who looked away, and then looked back with tears in her eyes. I wanted to tell you. Mother wasn't talking about the files. When I saw how you hated him, I wanted to say, he's not your father. Your father is a good, kind man who didn't have the courage to tell us himself. Rage came into Mother's eyes. He wanted to. I wouldn't let him. I'll tell you something, Mother. I loved Libo the way everybody in Milagro loved him. But he was willing to be a hypocrite, and so were you. And without anybody even guessing, the poison of your lies hurt us all. I don't blame you, Mother, or him, but I thank God for the speaker. He was willing to tell us the truth, and it set us free. It's easy to tell the truth, said Mother softly, when you don't love anybody. Is that what you think? Said Ella. I think I know something, Mother. I think you can't possibly know the truth about somebody unless you love them. I think the speaker loved Father. Marcaun, I mean. I think he understood him and loved him before he spoke. Mother didn't answer because she knew that it was true. And I know he loves Grego and Quara and Oriado and Miro and even King and me. I know he loves me. And when he shows me that he loves me, I know it's true because he never lies to anybody. Tears came out of Mother's eyes and drifted down her cheeks. I have lied to you and everybody else, Mother said. Her voice sounded weak and strained. But you have to believe me anyway, when I tell you that I love you. Ella embraced her mother, and for the first time in years, she felt warmth in her mother's response, because the lies between them now were gone. The speaker had erased the barrier, and there was no reason to be tentative and cautious anymore. You're thinking about that damnable speaker even now, aren't you? Whispered her mother. So are you, Ella answered. Both their bodies shook with Mother's laugh. Yes. Then she stopped laughing and pulled away, looked Ella in the eyes. Will he always come between us? Yes, said Ella. Like a bridge, he'll come between us, not a wall.
Miro saw the piggies when they were halfway down the hillside toward the fence. They were so silent in the forest, but the piggies had no great skill in moving through the copping. It rustled loudly as they ran. Or perhaps in coming to answer Miro's call, they felt no need to conceal themselves. As they came nearer, Miro recognized them. Arrow, Human, Mandashuva, Leaf Eater, Cups. He did not call out to them, nor did they speak when they arrived. Instead, they stood behind the fence opposite him and regarded him silently. No Xenador had ever called the piggies to the fence before. By their stillness, they showed their anxiety. I can't come to you anymore, said Miro. They waited for his explanation. The Framlings found out about us, breaking the law. They sealed the gate. Leaf Eater touched his chin. Do you know what it was the Framlings saw? Miro laughed bitterly. What didn't they see? Only one Framling ever came with us. No, said Human. The Hive Queen says it wasn't the speaker. The Hive Queen says they saw it from the sky. The satellites? What could they see from the sky? Maybe the hunt, said Arrow. Maybe the shearing of the Cabra, said Leaf Eater. Maybe the fields of Amaranth, said Cups. All of those, said Human. And maybe they saw that the wives had let 320 children be born since the first Amaranth harvest. 320, said Mandashuva. They saw that food would be plenty, said Arrow. Now we're sure to win the next war. Our enemies will be planted in huge new forests all over the plain, and the wives will put mother trees in every one of them. Miro felt sick. Is this what all their work and sacrifice was for? To give some transient advantage to one tribe of piggies? Almost, he said, Libo didn't die so you could conquer the world. But his training took over, and he asked a noncommittal question. Where are all these new children? None of the little brothers come to us, explained Human. We have too much to do, learning from you and teaching all the other brother houses. We can't be training little brothers. Then proudly he added, "Of the 300, fully half are children of my father, Ruter." Mandashuva nodded gravely. "The wives have great respect for what you have taught us, and they have great hope in the speaker for the dead. But what you tell us now, this is very bad. If the Framlings hate us, what will we do?" "I don't know," said Miro. For the moment, his mind was racing to try to cope with all the information they had just told him. 320 new babies. A population explosion. And Ruter somehow the father of half of them. Before today, Miro would have dismissed the statement of Ruter's fatherhood as part of the piggy's totemic belief system. But having seen a tree uproot itself and fall apart in response to singing, he was prepared to question all his old assumptions. Yet what good did it do to learn anything now? They'd never let him report again. He couldn't follow up. He'd be aboard a starship for the next quarter century while someone else did all his work, or worse, no one else. "Don't be unhappy," said Human. "You'll see. The speaker for the dead will make it all work out well." The speaker. Yes, he'll make everything work out fine, the way he did for me and Wanda, my sister. "The Hive Queen says he'll teach the Framlings to love us." "Teach the Framlings," said Miro. "He'd better do it quickly, then. It's too late for him to save me and Wanda. They're arresting us and taking us off-planet."
"To the stars?" asked Human, hopefully.
"Yes, to the stars, to stand trial, to be punished for helping you. It'll take us 22 years to get there, and they'll never let us come back." The piggies took a moment to absorb this information. "Fine," thought Miro. "Let them wonder how the speaker is going to solve everything for them. I trusted in the speaker, too, and it didn't do much for me." The piggies conferred together. Human emerged from the group and came closer to the fence.
"We'll hide you."
"They'll never find you in the forest," said Mandashuva. "They have machines that can track me by my smell," said Miro.
"Ah,
but doesn't the law forbid them to show us their machines?" asked Human. Miro shook his head. "It doesn't matter. The gate is sealed to me. I can't cross the fence." The piggies looked at each other.
"But you have Capim right there," said Arrow.
Miro looked stupidly at the grass. "So what?" he asked.
"Chew it," said Human.
"Why?" asked Miro.
"We've seen humans chewing capim," said Leaf Eater. "The other night on the hillside, we saw the speaker and some of the robe humans chewing capim."
"And many other times," said Mandashuva. Their impatience with him was frustrating. "What does that have to do with the fence?" Again, the piggies looked at each other. Finally, Mandashuva tore off a blade of capim near the ground, folded it carefully into a thick wad, and put it in his mouth to chew it. He sat down after a while. The others began teasing him, poking him with their fingers, pinching him. He showed no sign of noticing. Finally, Human gave him a particularly vicious pinch, and when Mandashuva did not respond, they began saying, in male's language,
"Ready! Time to go! Now! Ready!"
Mandashuva stood up, a bit shaky for a moment. Then he ran at the fence and scrambled to the top, flipped over, and landed on all fours on the same side as Miro. Miro leaped to his feet and began to cry out just as Mandashuva reached the top. By the time he finished his cry, Mandashuva was standing up and dusting himself off.
"You can't do that," said Miro. "It stimulates all the pain nerves in the body. The fence can't be crossed."
"Oh," said Mandashuva. From the other side of the fence, Human was rubbing his thighs together.
"He didn't know," he said. "The humans don't know."
"It's an anesthetic," said Miro. "It stops you from feeling pain."
"No," said Mandashuva. "I feel the pain. Very bad pain. Worst pain in the world."
"Ruter says the fence is even worse than dying," said Human. "Pain in all the places." "But you don't care," said Miro.
"It's happening to your other self," said Mandashuva. "It's happening to your animal self."
"But your tree self doesn't care."
"It makes you be your tree self."
Then Miro remembered a detail that had been lost in the grotesquerie of Lebo's death. The dead man's mouth had been filled with a wad of capim. So had the mouth of every piggy that had died. Anesthetic. The death looked like hideous torture, but pain was not the purpose of it. They used an anesthetic. It had nothing to do with pain.
"So," said Mandashuva, "chew the grass and come with us. We'll hide you."
Wanda, said Miro.
Oh, I'll go get her, said Mandashuva. You don't know where she lives.
Yes, I do, said Mandashuva.
We do this many times a year, said Human. We know where everybody lives.
But no one has ever seen you, said Miro.
We're very secret, said Mandashuva. Besides, nobody is looking for us.
Miro imagined dozens of piggies creeping about in Milagre in the middle of the night. No guard was kept. Only a few people had business that took them out in the darkness, and the piggies were small. Small enough to duck down in the capim and disappear completely. No wonder they knew about metal and machines, despite all the rules designed to keep them from learning about them. No doubt they had seen the mines, had watched the shuttle land, had seen the kilns firing the bricks, had watched the fazenderos plowing and planting the human-specific amaranth. No wonder they had known what to ask for. How stupid of us to think we could cut them off from our culture. They kept far more secrets from us than we could possibly keep from them. So much for cultural superiority. Miro pulled up his own blade of capim.
No, said Mandashuva, taking the blade from his hands. You don't get the root part. If you take the root part, it doesn't do you any good.
He threw away Miro's blade and tore off his own, about 10 centimeters above the base. Then he folded it and handed it to Miro, who began to chew it. Mandashuva pinched and poked him.
Don't worry about that, said Miro. Go get Wanda. They could arrest her any minute. Go. Now, go on.
Mandashuva looked at the others, and, seeing some invisible signal of consent, jogged off along the fence line toward the slopes of Villa Alta, where Wanda lived. Miro chewed a little more. He pinched himself. As the piggy said, he felt the pain, but he didn't care. All he cared about was that this was a way out, a way to stay on Lusitania, to stay, perhaps, with Wanda. Forget the rules, all the rules. They had no power over him once he left the human enclave and entered the piggy's forest. He would become a renegade, as they already accused him of being, and he and Wanda could leave behind all the insane rules of human behavior and live as they wanted to, and raise a family of humans who had completely new values, learned from the piggies, from the forest life. Something new in the 100 worlds, and Congress would be powerless to stop them. He ran at the fence and seized it with both hands. The pain was no less than before, but now he didn't care. He scrambled up to the top, but with each new handhold, the pain grew more intense, and he began to care. He began to care very much about the pain. He began to realize that the capim had no anesthetic effect on him at all, but by this time he was already at the top of the fence. The pain was maddening. He couldn't think. Momentum carried him above the top, and as he balanced there, his head passed through the vertical field of the fence. All the pain possible to his body came to his brain at once, as if every part of him were on fire. The little ones watched in horror, as their friend hung there atop the fence, his head and torso on one side, his hips and legs on the other. At once they cried out, reached for him, tried to pull him down. Since they had not chewed capim, they dared not touch the fence. Hearing their cries, Mandashuva ran back. Enough of the anesthetic remained in his body that he could climb up and push the heavy human body over the top. Miro landed with a bone-crushing thump on the ground, his arm still touching the fence. The piggies pulled him away. His face was frozen in a rictus of agony.
Quick! Shouted Leaf Eater. Before he dies, we have to plant him.
No! Human answered, pushing Leaf Eater away from Miro's frozen body.
We don't know if he's dying. The pain is just an illusion. You know that. He doesn't have a wound. The pain should go away.
It isn't going away, said Arrow. Look at him. Miro's fists were clenched. His legs were doubled under him, and his spine and neck were arched backward. Though he was breathing in short, hard pants, his face seemed to grow even tighter with pain.
Before he dies, said Leaf Eater, we have to give him root.
Go get Wanda, said Human. He turned to face Mandashuva.
Now, go get her and tell her Miro is dying. Tell her the gate is sealed, and Miro is on this side of it, and he's dying.
Mandashuva took off at a run.
The secretary opened the door, but not until he actually saw Novenia did Ender allow himself to feel relief. When he sent Ella for her, he was sure that she would come
But as they waited so many long minutes for her arrival, he began to doubt his understanding of her. There had been no need to doubt. She was the woman that he thought she was. He noticed that her hair was down and windblown. And for the first time since he came to Lusitania, Ender saw in her face a clear image of the girl who in her anguish had summoned him less than 2 weeks, more than 20 years ago. She looked tense, worried, but Ender knew her anxiety was because of her present situation, coming into the bishop's own chambers so shortly after the disclosure of her transgressions. If Ella told her about the danger to Miro, that, too, might be part of her tension. All this was transient. Ender could see in her face, in the relaxation of her movement, in the steadiness of her gaze, that the end of her long deception was indeed the gift he had hoped, had believed it would be. I did not come to hurt you, Novinia, and I'm glad to see that my speaking has brought you better things than shame. Novinia stood for a moment looking at the bishop, not defiantly, but politely, with dignity. He responded the same way, quietly offering her a seat. Dom Cristan started to rise from his stool, but she shook her head, smiled, took another stool near the wall, near Ender. Ella came and stood behind and beside her mother, so she was also partly behind Ender, like a daughter standing between her parents, thought Ender. And then he thrust the thought away from him and refused to think of it any more. There were far more important matters at hand. "I see," said Boschigna, "that you intend this meeting to be an interesting one." "I think Congress decided that already," said Donna Crista.
"Your son is accused," Bishop Peregrino began, "of crimes against..."
"I know what he's accused of," said Novinia. "I didn't know until tonight when Ella told me, but I'm not surprised. My daughter, Eleonora, has also been defying some rules her master set for her. Both of them have a higher allegiance to their own conscience than to the rules others set down for them. It's a failing if your object is to maintain order, but if your goal is to learn and adapt, it's a virtue."
"Your son isn't on trial here," said Dom Cristan.
"I asked you to meet together," said Ender, "because a decision must be made whether or not to comply with the orders given us by Starway's Congress."
"We don't have much choice," said Bishop Peregrino.
"There are many choices," said Ender, "and many reasons for choosing. You already made one choice. When you found your files being stripped, you decided to try to save them, and you decided to trust them with me, a stranger. Your trust was not misplaced. I'll return your files to you whenever you ask, unread, unaltered."
"Thank you," said Donna Crista. "But we did that before we knew the gravity of the charge."
"They're going to evacuate us," said Dom Cristan. "They control everything," said Bishop Peregrino.
"I already told him that," said Boschigna.
"They don't control everything," said Ender. "They only control you through the Ansible connection."
"We can't cut off the Ansible," said Bishop Peregrino. "That is our only connection with the Vatican."
"I don't suggest cutting off the Ansible. I only tell you what I can do. And when I tell you this, I am trusting you the way you trusted me. Because if you repeat this to anyone, the cost to me and to someone else whom I love and depend on would be immeasurable."
He looked at each of them, and each in turn nodded acquiescence. "I have a friend whose control over Ansible communications among all the 100 worlds is complete and completely unsuspected. I'm the only one who knows what she can do, and she has told me that when I ask her to, she can make it seem to all the Fremlings that we here on Lusitania have cut off our Ansible connection. And yet we will have the ability to send guarded messages if we want to the Vatican, to the offices of your order. We can read distant records, intercept distant communications. In short, we will have eyes and they will be blind. Cutting off the Ansible, or even seeming to, would be an act of rebellion, of war." Boschigna was saying it as harshly as possible, but Ender could see that the idea appealed to her, though she was resisting it with all her might.
"I will say, though, that if we were insane enough to decide on war, what the speaker is offering us is a clear advantage. We'd need any advantage we could get if we were mad enough to rebel."
We have nothing to gain by rebellion, said the bishop, and everything to lose. I grieve for the tragedy it would be to send Miro and Wanda to stand trial on another world, especially because they are so young. But the court will no doubt take that into account and treat them with mercy. And by complying with the orders of the committee, we will save this community much suffering.
Don't you think that having to evacuate this world will also cause them suffering? Asked Ender.
Yes, yes, it will, but a law was broken, and the penalty must be paid.
What if the law was based on a misunderstanding, and the penalty is far out of proportion to the sin?
We can't be the judges of that, said the bishop.
We are the judges of that. If we go along with congressional orders, then we're saying that the law is good and the punishment is just. And it may be that at the end of this meeting you'll decide exactly that, but there are some things you must know before you can make your decision. Some of those things I can tell you, and some of those things only Ella and Novinia can tell you. You shouldn't make your decision until you know all that we know.
I'm always glad to know as much as possible, said the bishop. Of course the final decision is Boschini's, not mine.
The final decision belongs to all of you together, the civil and religious and intellectual leadership of Lusitania. If any one of you decides against rebellion, rebellion is impossible. Without the church's support, Boschini can't lead. Without civil support, the church has no power.
We have no power, said Dom Cristal. Only opinions.
Every adult in Lusitania looks to you for wisdom and fair-mindedness.
You forget a fourth power, said Bishop Peregrino.
Yourself. I'm a Framling here.
A most extraordinary Framling, said the bishop. In your 4 days here, you have captured the soul of this people in a way I feared and foretold. Now you counsel rebellion that could cost us everything. You are as dangerous as Satan. And yet, here you are, submitting to our authority, as if you weren't free to get on the shuttle and leave here when the starship returns to Trondheim with our 2 young criminals aboard.
I submit to your authority, said Ender, because I don't want to be a Framling here. I want to be your citizen, your student, your parishioner.
As a speaker for the dead? Asked the bishop.
As Andrew Wiggin. I have some other skills that might be useful, particularly if you rebel, and I have other work to do that can't be done if humans are taken from Lusitania.
We don't doubt your sincerity, said the bishop. But you must forgive us if we are doubtful about casting in with a citizen who is something of a latecomer.
Ender nodded. The bishop could not say more until he knew more. Let me tell you first what I know. Today, this afternoon, I went out into the forest with Miro and Wanda.
You? You also broke the law! The bishop half rose from his chair.
Boschini reached forward, gestured to settle the bishop's ire. The intrusion in our files began long before this afternoon. The congressional order couldn't possibly be related to his infraction.
I broke the law, said Ender,
because the piggies were asking for me, demanding, in fact, to see me. They had seen the shuttle land. They knew that I was here. And for good or ill, they had read The Hive Queen and the Hegemon.
They gave the piggies that book, said the bishop.
They also gave them the New Testament, said Ender. But surely you won't be surprised to learn that the piggies found much in common between themselves and the Hive Queen. Let me tell you what the piggies said. They begged me to convince all the 100 worlds to end the rules that keep them isolated here. You see, the piggies don't think of the fence the way we do. We see it as a way of protecting their culture from human influence and corruption. They see it as a way of keeping them from learning all the wonderful secrets that we know. They imagine our ships going from star to star, colonizing them, filling them up. And 5 or 10,000 years from now, when they finally learn all that we refuse to teach them, they'll emerge into space to find all the worlds filled up. No place for them at all. They think of our fence as a form of species murder. We will keep them on Lusitania like animals in a zoo, while we go out and take all the rest of the universe.
That's nonsense, said Dom Cristal. That isn't our intention at all.
Isn't it? Ender retorted.
Why are we so anxious to keep them from any influence from our culture?
It isn't just in the interest of science. It isn't just good xenological procedure.
Remember, please, that our discovery of the Ansible, of Starflight, of partial gravity control, even of the weapon we used to destroy the buggers, all of them came as a direct result of our contact with the buggers. We learned most of the technology from the machines they left behind from their first foray into Earth's star system. We were using those machines long before we understood them. Some of them, like the Philotic Bond, we don't even understand now. We are in space precisely because of the impact of a devastatingly superior culture. And yet, in only a few generations, we took their machines, surpassed them, and destroyed them. That's what our fence means. We're afraid the piggies will do the same to us. And they know that's what it means. They know it, and they hate it.